The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 718, recorded on March 20th, 2024.
TD Gaming Podcast and 551st episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am TJ Dunzer.
I am Scott Dirk.
And I am John Fowler.
VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry.
Right, and let's talk about what we've been playing. I'll start first. I've been playing a new game called Tram Simulator, and TJ, you remember me playing Bus Simulator.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is Tram Simulator. And instead of a free-moving bus, you're on a tram going around tracks, set tracks, but with switches. And you'd think it would be a lot easier than Bus Simulator. But no, it's actually a lot harder because it's sort of like you have to make sure the tram turns in time. You have to make sure you don't hit anybody. You have to make sure that your acceleration-deceleration does it properly. And here's the thing about trams. They can't go backwards. So, all of these things all at once. And I would like the game better except for one little mistake that they made in design. And that is on the minimap, the tram lines and the path you're supposed to go are both a bright yellow, with the path you're supposed to go a little bit different. And I swear, I don't know why they did that. Maybe they wanted to make it artificially harder, but it's hard as is. So what happens is, it's just ridiculous. You should have it a different color so I know which way the tram's supposed to go. Even if I made the track, I still need to see which way the tram's supposed to go, especially since you can't go backwards. It's really annoying. So that's the one issue I have with it. Otherwise, it's like Bus Simulator, and it's pretty fun. Because you have to juggle so many things, it's almost like doing a QuickTime event every second of the game. The other game that just came out, which I'm playing, is MLB The Show 24. And it's better than last year's. The Road to the Show is better. I like what they do with your character. You're not automatically, you know, a top prospect. You know, you have to go through the Major League Baseball's version of the trials. Oh God, I forgot the name of it. You know what I'm talking about? You know, the combine, right? And the combine is pretty reasonable. And whenever you're drafted, I was drafted 10th in the 10th round, which is a pleasant surprise to me. Usually, you know, it's like you're the number one star. You're just another minor league player, and you're going to have to work at it, you know? After a month, I was only the 98th best of the top 100 prospects, and the 6th best in the Dodgers organization. So far, I'm liking it. I haven't tried any of the modes. I just do Road to the Show for the most part. It's still strange to see the PlayStation logo and Sony on the boot-up screen. It's just very, very weird. And finally, Velatro. So, I've been getting more into it, and I've been finding engines, because it's an engine game, you know, it's like Wingspan, you know, you have to find the right engine. One engine I found was wildly successful. I forgot exactly what I was doing in it, but let's just say, when I was beating, you know, level 9, because it only goes up to level 8, but I beat level 9, my multiplier was over 3,000. So I got, my highest score ever was 2.7 million chips. And I was looking ahead, and it's sort of like, yeah, it goes into trillions and even quadrillions later on, if you can possibly do it. And I did another engine on, so far, my favorite deck, and that's the Abandoned deck. So, the Abandoned deck, it has no face cards. It's just ace through 10. That's it. Of each thing.
That's
and I love it because, for one thing, You can ignore cars and have anything to do with face. And if you have a boss thing that says, oh, by the way, all the face cards are face down, I don't care. Don't care. I don't have any. It also makes it a lot easier to get full houses and flushes. As a matter of fact, that's when I realized there are hidden hands. There are hidden hands. What I discovered was five of a kind. And then another one, which is really funny, I found the flush house, in which you do a full house, but everything's the same suit. And I did not see the planet that's for five of a kind, but I did see flush house is Ceres. So, yeah, some really strange stuff. Now, you said, oh, I see you're going to do flush and royal flush and all that stuff. But what happens when you get, when all the diamonds are debuffed? And my answer is, guess what? Since I had level 10, I lucked out, in which twice I got it so that I could add 3 to Jupiter, which is flushes. So I got to the level 10 flush. And that's 256 times, what did I say, 18? And the jokers I had didn't care. So I would do these flushes, and it would just say, yep, okay. 256 times this, times this, times this, times this, times this. Oh, yeah, we're doing 30,000 at a pop, even though every single card is debuffed. It's just the multipliers alone that's getting past it. The one boss that tripped me before I could finish the deck was the one in which you only get 3 cards back when you use your cards. So I had to try to get it, you know, immediately, or do four of a kind. But the problem is that, you know, the other thing is I did not have 10 times royal, 10 times flush, or 10 times straight. So I was not able to get the real big bonuses, you know. But yeah, I mean, Bellatra's the thing that keeps on giving back. Oh, yeah, when I had 30 more, I think it was 30 cards. You have to have 30 or 20 cards. So like, when you have a large number of cards, you unlock a joker. In my case, I unlocked the diamond joker, in which he gives you a dollar for every diamond that you play.
Interesting.
But here's the other thing about my one with the 3 million was I got that joker in which, yeah, clubs and spades are the same, and diamonds and hearts are the same. So I didn't have to worry about hearts or diamonds, because they're the same. That one was a breaker. That one broke the game. So that's why I'm always looking for it. When you get that, flushes become no problem whatsoever, because you just basically have half the deck.
There's another card like that, like a Joker card, where you can create straights with
only four, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you one missing. Yeah. I've seen that card.
It's really good. It's really fun.
Yeah. Oh, well, here's the thing. You know what it allows you to do? It allows you to include a stone card with it.
Nice.
Because the stone card, for those you don't know, has no suit, has no rank, so it's always included. So you'll always get 50 extra chips. Oh, that's the other thing. The other card that breaks it is the card that says that every single card is counted. You know, usually it only counts the cards which form it. Like, if you do 3 of a kind and 2 other cards, it'll only do those 3 cards. It'll ignore the other 2 cards. With this card, it does all of them. So that makes high cards viable. Because what you can do is you can do a high card ace and then introduce all these other cards. But guess what? They're all multiplier cards. So, yeah. So, right now, I'm staying with the abandoned deck. I love it. It makes cycles go really fast, especially when you don't have to worry about face cards. Of course, there's always that card, which says every card is a face card, counts as a face card. I can't use it with this one, obviously, but it, you know, if you combine it with certain other jokers, it can be powerful too. But right now, I'm just doing this abandoned thing because I think I can get a run that's really, really high. I think I get to level 12. Or something like that. The other game I've started playing a lot of is City Skylines 2. And I've started to wise up on how the mechanics go. So I'm starting to really make... And here's the thing. I always start a little bit, you know, like... I only go to, like, level 6. And then I get tired because I make mistakes. and I keep starting over. This city that I'm starting right now, I already have a plan for. And I found out that having neighborhoods, and they're not called neighborhoods, but, you know, you create neighborhoods. And it gets away from that normally a lot of buildings will have a radius, right? But if you assign them to a neighborhood, assign them to neighborhoods, then it ignores that radius and people go there. Whether it's a hospital or a school, and it's really important for schools, right? You create, and right now I have an 8-lane street, 4 going each way. On one side is all the residential stuff. On the other side is the non-residential stuff. So I just, you know, so it's sort of like I have a division city. So they're never bothered by noise. Well, they are bothered by noise. They'll always be bothered by noise. But they're not bothered by pollution. And I found a little trick. When you want to build a blue region, you know, the commercial, they will tell you where they want to be. And if you build them where they want to be, they will grow fast, and then you'll get offices even quicker. I thought the offices were because people are educated, you know, and they have the university. No, I got it before I even built the university. So there's just a lot of things I'm uncovering as I do this. And I think you really – have you been playing City Skylines too, TJ?
I backed out of it for a while because I've been working on a few other things.
You should watch me play and see how I'm doing. Because I think it'll open your eyes a bit. The only thing I forgot to do was I forgot to build my internet towers. I have to wait until, and I'm not, I can't take any more money out in loan, so I have to wait while people complain that they have really bad reception. that's their one complaint, and that the city is noisy. But they're always going to complain about that. Even if I have electric buses and electric cabs, they still complain about noise. So, what can I do? Anyway, Scott, what have you been playing?
I've been playing a Metroidvania called Greek, but it's spelled G-R-E-A-K.
And yeah, they've been talking about that game around, yeah. It's actually 75% off on Steam right now, too.
Yeah, one of the reasons why I bought it, because it was really cheap on sale. And it's an interesting game because you're controlling three different characters pretty mm-hmm. much at the same time. And you can alternate between them and use them at the same time to do certain puzzles and get to areas by combining their skills and just basically figuring out how to mm-hmm. use them.
This game is just a little inspired by Ori.
yeah, a little.
You have a glowing character and it's in the dark woods. And the combat, the way you fight is similar, too.
But Ori's always by itself.
You have three characters here, yeah.
Yeah. And you got a story going on. I think Ori is visual storytelling, not as much as text. This one has a lot of text and characters speaking to you and talking to you about
what's
going on.
Unlike Ori, though, this one looks more like a cartoon. It looks it's a cel-shaded thing. It's like you're playing an anime.
Yeah. It's a nice atmospheric game, and it's pretty challenging, I think, the combat.
Yeah. It came out a few years ago, so...
Yeah, I just decided to try it out. And I'm also playing the Eastward DLC, Octopia. I've gotten a lot farther on it. I've built up my farm, and I've built several houses, and there's this interesting story going on. It's actually... acknowledging that this is a parallel world to the Eastward main story, and some of the characters are kind of curious about it, and you're just kind of restoring this abandoned theme park as a farm, but you're also exploring the area, and you're getting recipes and growing all these different crops. So it's been pretty fun, and it was a pretty cheap DLC, and I'm getting a lot of time out of it.
Speaking of crops, we're going to be talking about that later. how are you doing with the Aiden Chronicles?
I stopped playing that because I want the full game, and so I'm going to wait for...
See, that's my thing all the time, is that I'm waiting for it. I'm not spoiling anything.
Well, I mean, like, I didn't have any problem when I played the Sea of Stars beta or first... demo and then the demos that came out for consoles later on, I still enjoyed them in game. But I guess it was the way they did it. They made it kind of this alternate timeline thing where it's not canon. They're just showing you like the early build. And when they made the main game, there were a lot of differences. So I thought that was a good way of dealing with that.
Yeah, a lot of things are coming in April, including the Eclipse.
Yeah.
Okay, TJ, I'm going to guess you've been playing Dragon's Dogma 2.
Nope, I played the holy heck out of the new Alone in the Dark for review. I gotta say, it's pretty okay. So like, it's not the best game out there. It's not a perfect game. However, it's the best Alone in the Dark game that's been made in since.
That's not a difficult achievement.
Right.
Yeah, better than the last year. Yeah. So
this is like kind of what I would have expected Alone in the Dark to be when they finally got it right. It takes the game back to the original setting at Deer City.
Is Edward Carnby in it?
Edward Carnby is in it, as well as Emily Hartwood. You can play as both of them. And their stories play out a little bit differently. Like they have different interactions based on which one you're playing. The manor itself is such an interesting environment. Like the way that they move between Alone in the Dark is
very Resident Evil. Yeah.
Insanity heavy game. It's like the whole idea behind it is there's like a chthonic god that people are trying to bring to life, and it's shifting the rules of reality, but the characters themselves aren't certain whether it's actually happening or just inside their heads. And so it plays with that sense of insanity and just like dread and very, very up, like disturbing monster design and setting design and
atmosphere design. Here's the thing. Do you remember that game that was Agony? Do you remember Agony?
I do.
The monsters in this remind me of Agony.
They're better than in Agony. Like, I'll say that much.
They're still vagina monsters.
There's one type of creature that's like that, but the other ones, like, I was consistently impressed by how it handled its scares, how it handled the atmosphere. It has some weirdness with, like, the voice acting and the transitions between cutscenes and gameplay, where everything kind of feels abrupt when it transitions, and sometimes the characters themselves don't, I feel, emote the way that they should in the context of the situation. But it's still fun to explore, and it's still fun to solve the puzzles and mysteries in it. It's very investigative, and the combat is really punchy. The firearms like actually feel like they hit like a brick when you fire them at enemies. And ultimately, like, I gave this game a 7 when I reviewed it, but it was like a complicated 7 because what it ended up making me think about a lot was Silent Hill 4 and parts of Silent Hill 2.
Okay.
If, like, people love those games, but they weren't perfect either. They were actually kind of janky themselves in a lot of ways, and in ways that, like, kind of made them a little all the more charming. And I think Alone in the Dark has that same sort of janky charm to it, where it's not it's not a highly polished, perfect horror game the way that Resident Evil 4 Remake was, but it is a very good Alone in the Dark game.
It's telling that it brags that it got a 76 from PC Gamer. Sort of reminds me of a cross between Resident Evil and Alan Wake, actually. Maybe it's because he has that flashlight on his lapel there. Mm-hmm. That makes me think of Alan Wake.
Yeah, and it handles like the horror elements so well. You'll be like exploring a room and like minding your business, and then the room will just shift to drastically shift to like this hellscape of like just like a room where the floor is covered in like blood or some other substance, and there's body bags everywhere, and one of them is moving. And then without any sort of explanation, it'll shift back to the regular world. And you're just like, what happened? Why did that happen? I don't understand. And it's like, but it's not like in a bad way that like makes no sense. It's literally like this world, whether it's supernatural or not, is affecting the characters and they're starting to lose their grasp on reality. And I really appreciate how they went about that horror in the narrative. So if you liked the original Alone in the Darks, I think this is a good one.
The original, like the one from 1990 or something, the blocky one.
Mm-hmm.
By the way,
fun little Easter egg in the game. They actually included the 1993 character sprites as costumes for Carnby and Emily.
Wow.
It's really funny to go through the game. Like once you've beat the game once, it's funny to go through the game as those 1993 models.
On a side note, Dragon's Dogma 2 has been getting really high praise, except on PC where it's supposed to be right here. It's buggy as hell.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to jump into Dragon's Dogma 2 yet. Very excited for it. Going to be doing it soon. I'll probably have to be able to talk about it more in the next couple of weeks.
Floor just turned to review it,
and I had a yeah. But from all accounts, it sounds like they knocked it out of the park with that one.
Yeah, they just got to learn how to program on PCs.
Mm-hmm.
Heard a lot of good things about the Dragon's Dogma, and that I like how you described the. Oh, in the dark, I'm going to put that on my wish list.
Yeah. By the way, Dragon's Dogma, the original, with all the fixings in it, is really moving because it's on sale right now. Obviously, reasons for that, but you never got into Dragon's Dogma, now's the time. Anyways, we're going to move on to quick news. First up, Starfield's latest update doesn't add any content, but it does fix a galaxy list size of bugs. It makes improvements to photo mode and scanner usage, so it allows you to smile in the photo mode. So if you really wanted to have your character smiling, hey, I've abused that photo mode, by the way. You've seen some of the pictures I've taken. It's just some of the sights that you see is just extraordinary. I'm one of the people who Starfield was made for because I like to explore, and, there's a lot to explore, and there's so much realism in terms of the way the atmosphere is and physics and all that stuff. There's a lot of fixes and tweaks they made to it, though. Destiny finally gets a horde mode, and this is something that fans have been requiring for the past 10 years.
Yeah, this was, they call it onslaught mode, which, whatever. But it sounds like they're going to have like a 50 round horde mode in which player like teams of three can fight against increasingly difficult waves of enemies. And yeah, I don't understand why they do the team of three thing. Four seems
it's,
like
it's traditional for Gears of War.
Didn't Gears of War let you do four people?
I don't know. I just remember three people, multiplayer in Gears of War.
Huh. Either way, like it's
maybe the new one in which you're running out of the thing, maybe there's more people, but the original Gears of War horde mode, which started it all. Although I will say, Firefight is still my jam. Halo Firefight. I could do that forever.
Yeah. And this one looks like, Destiny 2 is still a pretty fun game when it comes to just, like, the basic shooting, so as a horde mode in this seems like it ought to be pretty fun.
PSVR 2 production reportedly paused as Sony seeks to move backlog of unsold units. Sales have been on the decline quarter to quarter with little first-party software support. PlayStation is reportedly pausing production on the PSVR 2. So there's two things going on here. One, yeah, this was not going to sell. This was not going to sell because usually when you get people who play VR usually do it on PC for several reasons. The biggest reason is that there's a whole metric fuck ton of VR games you can play on Steam. And again, a device like the MetaQuest, you just plug it in, and they even have a Steam app that allows you to that makes it easier if you play the VR Steam games on your MetaQuest, And two, Sony does this. Sony makes hardware, then doesn't release any software for it. Remember the PS Vita? Same thing. They just expect people to want the hardware and not care about software. This is why the PlayStation 3 had such a bad time of it. Because remember, Jim Ryan said, or no, it wasn't Jim Ryan, was it Don Matrick? Someone said, yeah, people will buy the PlayStation 3, even if it doesn't have any games with it. Presumably going by the logic that a lot of people bought PS2s but never bought PS2 games because they just wanted a cheap DVD player. But that's not, the Blu-ray is not something as revolutionary as a DVD. Going from VHS to DVD is not the same as going from DVD to Blu-ray. And if you're going to make a hardware, you have to really commit to it.
Yeah, it makes me supremely grumpy how little Sony has put into support of the PSVR 2. Because I've played it, I have it, I've used it. It's everything I would want a headset that competes with Meta to be, like, short of just, like, the one tether cable, which isn't even that big of a deal because there's a lot of slack to it and it connects into a place that's not intrusive. I hate that they've released so few games on this thing that could actually come out of PlayStation Studios. It's ridiculous that they have one of the best headsets out there right now and they just do nothing with it.
Is it compatible with a PC though?
They're working on that. They are currently developing a PC compatibility for the PSVR 2, but it's still going to take a bit. And I can't help but feel like they just continue to hope that other developers will pick up the slack for them.
But that's not how it works.
And yes, that's not how it works, but that's how it feels that they're going about it, because they've had Horizon Call of the Mountain VR, and then maybe one other game. I can't think of another PlayStation Studio games that has come to PSVR 2. I've seen plenty of third-party software like port over to it, but like never anything that was designed specifically for it. And
so just for some context, the PSVR 2 was released last year on February 22nd. So it's had a year, right?
Yeah. It's disappointing on so many levels, and it's completely Sony being the architect of their own failure here. If they would just put the effort into making this thing sing. It's a great headset. It is capable of a lot of cool stuff. And they just let it sit there collecting dust.
Yeah. I mean, I checked on Amazon to see how much the MetaQuest 3 is. It's still $500. So I'm still holding off on it. Because I heard that the MetaQuest 3 is fantastic. It has so many upgrades and improvements, you know, that I'm interested, but not $500 interested. It's a big ask.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyways, Star Citizen 1.0 in sight. And according to Chris Roberts, while we recognize there's no definitive finish line in an online MMO, we will always be adding new features and content for many, many years to come. Star Citizen 1.0 is what we consider the features and content set to represent commercial release. And the thing that I care about, they said also that Squadron 42 is getting close to completion as well. It's been a long, strange journey and also with everything that RSI is going for with the sexual harassment suit. It's just, we need some good news to give people, you know? And the thing is, a lot of people who do play Star Citizen the way it is now are having a lot of fun with it. And the engine is absolutely amazing. It makes Starfield look, you know, like a console game in comparison, which actually it is a console game for the most part. I'm looking forward to Squadron 42. I can't wait to see what they do with it.
Yeah, this has been a long time coming, huh? Like we're finally seeing this game come towards the finish line that has been like so much crowdfunding and so many little things that have been released after the fact. And now they're about to hit that 1.0.
Yeah. The biggest problem with Star Citizen has always been feature creep. Seems like RSA says, hey, wouldn't this be cool if... ... You know. Just get the game out. You know? It doesn't have to be the everything game. It just has to do, you know... And that's why a lot. But here's the thing: people wonder. You have to understand who Chris Roberts is. Chris Roberts is the space combat sim guy, wing commander, freelancer, everything. He built what we know as a space combat sim. Everything you see in a space combat sim, they usually take a lot of ideas from his games, right? So this is the guy who started it all, making a space combat sim. And when we find out, when you give him a gigantic budget, he's going to try and do everything.
Yeah, seems that way. And it truly does seem like they tried to do everything and then came up with more stuff to do even after that.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that people are shady about is spending a lot of money on the ships, right? You know, spend $500 on that ship. It's like these gigantic cruisers, like $1,200. Although I'm going to tell you something. If you ever see one of these behemoths, one of these mining behemoths, it's like, oh yeah, I could see why people would pay this for it, you know? It's going to be EVE Online, except more action.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of clans going on in this game. I can already tell. This is going to be one of those things in which you better align yourself to a clan, or else you're just going to be shot to hell. I've always just wanted to be an explorer in these type of games, which is why I like Elite Dangerous so much, and also don't like Elite Dangerous so much. I'd love to see, and the thing about Star Citizen is that it's going to have a limited universe, but it's all going to be curated, so... I've seen some of the cities that you can go to. They're fantastic. So I'm looking forward to it. Like I said, I can't wait to see how the single-player game is going to go. It should be interesting. Especially since it's, you know, starring Mark Hamill and Gary Oldman and all these other big stars. We'll see. And the music, by the way, I always listen to the music. The music by Pedro Camacho is exquisite. And sometimes, you know what, sometimes I put on a playlist of all the commercials from Star Citizen. You know, the fake commercials they have. There's sort of the kayfabe there, so it's like sometimes I just put that on and pretend I'm in the future and these are real commercials that are on my TV. Stellaris spinoff Digi's title becomes Nexus 5X. The developer didn't want players to think it was Stellaris Lite. So basically, this is basically Stellaris that's condensed down to that 1 hour.
That is nice, because Stellaris, those games take hours upon hours upon hours to get from the beginning of like when you first start your star system to the end game. And it's got, like, Stellaris is unfortunately one of those games where, like, it doesn't avoid that drag that you get, like, kind of in the middle to late game, where you just kind of, you've explored your whole tech tree as far as you want, as far as what you're specializing in. You've got your empire set. And you end up at kind of a lull where you're just kind of grinding as much as you can to get the next unlock, which feels like a long time to get there when you get into that mid to late game grind.
Yeah, so they wanted this to be sort of like a board game. But I will say this, though. The games that it's emulating or like Twilight Imperium, and those games take 10 hours in person, minimum.
Yeah, and so the idea of reducing, like, if they can still make it feel as fun as Stellaris is, like, but reduce that grind down to a one-hour game, I like that. I like the idea of bite-sized Stellaris.
Yeah, it's basically a board game. That's what they said. We're doing this like it's a board game, not like a sweeping thing. That's why it's 5X. You know, the 4X is explore, you know, and all that stuff. The 5X in this one is express.
Interesting.
Yep. Assassin's Creed Jade likely delayed to 2005. According, the development team is being reorganized, which tells me they started it and then they tore it down and they're starting it from scratch again, or at least near from scratch. So there's some drama going on with Assassin's Creed.
Seems like Ubisoft is kind of in a tumultuous state right now. Like, first off, Skull and Bones was such a weird investment for the company, despite all the signs that it was not looking very good.
Basically, Skull and Bones is a wet fart. Mm-hmm. That's all it is.
Skull and Bones is a great advertisement for Sea of Thieves.
You know what Skull and Bones is? That I've sampled it. This is a fucking cell phone game. It plays like a cell phone game, and it should have been priced like a cell phone game. And $10, people would love it. People would love it if it was $10. But they had a special thing for $100, and it's like, no, not worth it.
How dare you, Jonah? This is a quadruple A game. Don't you understand? Don't you understand that it's a quadruple A game, and because of that, they have to charge $70?
It may be, but you know, here's the thing. What's criminal is that if it was a scaled down $10 game, this game is actually really fun because then your expectations are lowered. You know, like you don't get off your ship to get resources. You just, you know, they just go down like you're pressing your touchscreen. It's a really good cell phone game.
Yeah, if it was a $10 cell phone game, it would be much easier to deal with things.
Not even a ten dollar. So I just mean like $15, you know, game that they release, or even maybe just $20, you know, sort of like one of those things in which they give a quickie thing out.
Regardless, I mean, if it was a $15 game, a cell phone game, it would be
not a cell phone game. I mean a console game, $15, because you're not gonna sell.
It would be much more palatable when you come across things like press button to board and loot, and then just get a cutscene of your dudes running onto their ship and taking everything. That's so dumb. Like, why would you take one of the funnest parts of being a pirate out of being a pirate?
Yeah, it's pared down so much like a cell phone game, though. It's like playing Game Dev Story in a way, you know? Mm-hmm. If it was a $10 to $15 game, I think people would really, really enjoy it.
Yeah, I think so too. Yep. It would certainly be easier to look past the multitude of flaws.
And the flaws are not really flaws. It's just a different type of game, you know? They're not flaws. They're just not what Ubisoft promised, and not what, you know, you think is worth the money that you're paying for it. You can find better elsewhere.
Yeah. You sure can.
Anyways, we also have another Ubisoft thing, which we can get into later. Now we're going to get into game news. Stardew Valley's 1.6 update is finally live, and this comes from some PC Gamer. The Stardew Valley 1.6 update is live, and we've got the full rundown of all the changes of the long-awaited update. The update was supposed to be small, and creator Eric Barone, a.k.a. Concerned 8, warned players in 2022 that it will mostly focus on support for modders, and it, quote-unquote, won't be huge. That promise didn't last long. Speaking of feature creep, as Barone kept piling things on, a new farm type, 3 new festivals, support for 8-person multiplayer, new late-game content, and more. And when I say more, I'm going to tell you something. I have my podcast notes up, and I posted every single thing that was in the podcast notes. It's 19 pages long.
That's a lot of patch notes.
Yep. Note that Barone recently said that over 1,000 mods have been updated to be compatible with Stardew 1.6, but if you prefer not to update, he's also added a public branch on Steam that will enable players to stick with version 1.5.6.
Less of a patch and more of an expansion, it seems like.
Yeah, as an update, Stardew Valley broke a new record yesterday as it beat its own player count on Steam, reaching a whopping almost 150,000 people, meaning it's currently 7th most played game, wedged in between Helldivers 2 and GTA 5. Previously, the record for player count for Stardew Valley was 94,000 back in January 2021 when the 1.5.4 patch was released. I'm very concerned with Eric Barone. Eric, if you're listening to this podcast for whatever reason, the sun is your friend. You need to go out. You need to go out into the sun, and you need to get away from your computer for a bit.
I mean, to a certain degree, he's got to enjoy working on Stardew Valley to go back and like turn what was supposed to be a quick fix patch and do like a full-on expansion patch.
Shall I mention that Stardew Valley is still only $15? Now let's compare that with Skull and Bones.
I mean, if anybody does passion project work. It's this game and this creator, you know, because they really seem to put a lot of love into it.
I don't think he's ever going to make anything else than Stardew Valley. I think there's going to be his one game, and he's just going to keep iterating on it.
Well, he's still doing the Chocolatier.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's eventually going to put out a Haunted Chocolatier, and that game looks fun,
too. Oh, man, I forgot that. I forgot about that. That game is more like, you know, like Cake Mania, you know? It's not quite the same thing. I'm really glad that Microsoft gave him a pile of money to put it on Game Pass, because he's doing... He's not really getting a lot of new sales. The people who want to play Stardew Valley already own it, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, Microsoft gave him a bucketload of money, and I'm glad. Maybe, you know, here's the thing. Maybe Microsoft giving him a bucketload of money enabled him to say, you know what? Let me work on this a bit more.
It's also worth noting that update 1.5, which was supposed to be the final major update to the game, was also, like, as massive as 1.6 was. He 1.5 was a huge, huge patch for this game. And that's why everybody thought, okay, well, and he even said it himself, like 1.5 is the big thing. That's the bookend. We're going to do some maintenance work and that's about it. But 1.5 is my last big thing for this game. Lo and behold, 1.6. And that's why I think that he has to enjoy working on this game, is because, like, you don't just go back and
hope he enjoys
something that much.
I hope he isn't OCD and just feels compelled to do it against his will. It's like I have to fix.
He'd set expectations at 1.5. He told everybody, like, "Nah, I'm done." And then he was like, "Wait a minute, hold on."
Again, like I said, Eric, if you're listening, please go outside. At least for a week. Just stay away from your computer. Please. I'm concerned for your health. Remember to eat. Speaking of patches, you got this, DJ.
Okay. Are we on... Star Wars Battlefront?
Yeah.
Star Wars Battlefront Classic Collection gets first patch following troubled launch from Eurogamer. Star Wars Battlefront Classic Collection did not have a good debut. On its release, players were met with a myriad of bugs and limited servers for each platform, resulting in many asking for a refund. The collection currently sits at an overwhelmingly negative review on Steam. Asper acknowledged the poor launch state soon after the collection was released, stating that it had experienced critical errors and would work to address the many issues. Now it is starting to make a good on that promise with the first major patch for its Star Wars Battlefront collection. The patch aims to address a multitude of issues across the multiplayer, audio, and visuals, many of which really should have been ready at launch. It is available now for those on Steam, with Asper saying it's still in submission and certification process for PlayStation, Xbox, and Nintendo consoles.
I think the Star Wars Battlefront Classic Collection is going to be fine. I mean, Aspyr made the Tomb Raider trilogy, right? And that was loved upon release. I just think, you know, making a multiplayer online game is a different beast. I don't think they've ever attempted that, actually, now that I think about it. So this may be something new for them that they're trying to work on.
Yeah. We talked about it this last time. Like, I still can't fathom how they thought that they could launch with as few servers as they had, with as little player capacity as they had, and thought that, like, everybody would be cool with that.
I think they underestimated how many people wanted this.
To say the least, but Battlefront fans are, like, these games are awesome. They were awesome back in the day.
Well, here's the thing. You know, they probably think, well, you know, there's Star Wars Battlefront already. I mean, we're just making... older. Why would people go back to the older versions of these games? Why would they do it? Well, the answer is last week we talked about how these people were making their own for their own Halo 2 matchmaking system.
Yeah, but it's good.
And why GoldenEye multiplayer is still highly, you know, done.
Yeah, and I think it's like it's worth noting. I'm glad to see that this is getting patched, and I'm glad to see that they're putting the effort in, because it's worth noting. Asper isn't a bad group. They've done a lot of good work in porting. Like, they're the reason why we can play a lot of the old Star Wars games at all on things like Nintendo Switch and the new consoles.
And also Tomb Raider, which was released, like, a few months ago, and which people love.
Yeah. So, like, it's not the idea. It's not like it's not a shovelware studio that's just putting out shoddy work and just hoping nobody notices. Asper is pretty good at what they do, and this is like a rare miss for them.
Like I said, it'll be fine. I'm willing to bet you a year from now people will be loving the Star Wars Battlefront Classic Collection and just remembering the bad old days when it was released buggy. Speaking of which, Alpha Centauri is now available on Good Old Games. And I'm wondering how they did that. Did they remove... Oh, God, I hope they didn't remove the song. Turn up the radio. Because that was the highlight of the entire game. That would be it would be a criminal thing if Turn Up the Radio was taken off, which is why it's on Good Old Games. By the way, if I buy it, it'll be the fourth time I bought that damn game.
Alpha Protocol?
Yeah. It'll be the fourth time I bought that damn game.
You gotta go in there and get the achievements?
I don't care about GOG achievements. The thing is that I first bought it, you know, when it first came out. And this is all PC version, by the way. I never got the Xbox 360 version. And then I couldn't find it anywhere, and I found it for $3, a box copy for $3. So then I had two copies. Then Steam had it, and they had a sale of $1.99. And I thought, you know what, I might as well get the Steam version, because guess what? Then I won't have to worry about a disc anymore. I don't want to have to worry about entering the code. So, yeah. If I get it, it'll be my fourth time I got it. Because I tried playing it on Steam, the Steam version, it does not work. So I'm assuming the GOG version works.
I mean, that's what GOG is kind of known for. I would hope so.
I hope so, too. The only thing I hope is that it still has the has Turn Up the Radio.
Yeah. I can't remember how much I played of the original game. I played it on its original platform. I played it on Xbox 360.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like I remember going very, like, I remember going pretty heavy down the stealth and...
So did I. Huh? Yeah. I did stealth as well.
Yeah, because...
Stealth and pistol.
There was one in there where you could, like, take out two enemies at the same time if they were close enough to each other.
Oh, forget that. You could actually literally vanish.
That's nice.
And also, the chain shot, when you max it out, it was basically the I win button.
Yeah. There's a lot of cool stuff you could do in that game. I wouldn't mind going back in there and playing with things like the social tree or like the sheer combat tree. Because you could play that game basically as like a full-on third-person shooter if you went down the full-on combat tree.
Here's the thing. The styles, they said, are the three JBs. You could be James Bond, Jason Bourne, or Jack Bauer.
Yeah, and so I kind of want to explore that James Bond or that Jason Bourne look.
So anyways, moving on, Scott. Scott?
Yeah, I'm here. Okay, Marathon Fan reveal coming to Steam with Bungie's blessing. Oh, I'm sorry, let me redo that. Marathon Fan Revival coming to Steam with Bungie's blessing. This is from Eurogamer. Here's something to tide you over until Bungie releases its rebooted Marathon. There's a freeware fan revival for 1994 FPS known as Classic Marathon, and it's coming to Steam soon. This project is from Steam, the same team that brought us ELF1, and an open source engine built for current systems based on Marathon 2 source code. While the team has promised Classic Marathon Steam will be authentic experience, there are of course a few extra bells and whistles to bring the revival up to more modern standards. For example, there'll be an optional widescreen HUD support and 60 FPS interpolation, which will improve smoothness of the animation over original without breaking the game logic. This is just in case original is too authentic, the Classic Marathon team said. The project also has Bungie support. Yep, this is real and will be free. Bungie told PC Gamer of Classic Marathon upcoming Steam release. We're very supportive of the Marathon community and Elf's One dedication here to bring the original Marathon to PC, Linux, and Mac for everyone to experience with cross-platform play available in multiplayer. This is a true tribute to the original game. We don't have a release date for Classic Marathon Steam debut, but then again, we also don't have a release date for Bungie's Marathon reboot either. The PvP reimagining was announced back in May last year with no specific launch window. However, last October, reports suggested it would be coming out soon, sometime 2025.
You know, I'd like to say it's cool of Bungie, but then I'm thinking, you know, Bungie's having so many problems with their Marathon reboot. They're probably ecstatic that someone else is releasing Marathon to keep it in people's brain space. Sort of like, yeah, we're screwing up over here, but hey, look, there's Marathon!
I mean, yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with you, because Bungie has not had a good 2024 so far. What with all the delays that they've had to do, what with the layoffs they did, what with several different things that are kind of all self-inflicted and kind of not, because of what Sony is doing as well. And I don't know. I'm curious to see how Marathon ends up, but it's going to be a while still. And so, I don't know. I don't mind going back and checking out the original because I've never played it before.
It's on XBLA. They have Marathon Durandal, which is, I think, the third game in the series.
Yeah, but I would like to try the first one.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. It's just so many things going around with Bungie right now. It's just like, here's the thing. If Sony acquires Bungie fully, they take over, you may not be able to play Marathon on Xbox. So this free Classic Marathon may be the only way you get to play Marathon for a long while.
That is nice. I think that's cool. And I think it's cool that Bungie actually went ahead and said, yeah, okay, you can do that.
Unlike some other people like Nintendo.
I think to a certain degree, Bungie realizes like they aren't going to be stealing from the new Marathon by playing the old Marathon.
No. Also, I don't know, a PvP version of Marathon, you know.
Not just any PvP, an extraction shooter PvP.
Yeah. Well, let's move on. Ubisoft reveals generative AI project for NPC dialogue, and this comes just from Shaq News. It's no secret that Assassin's Creed developer Ubisoft is interested in making generative AI in its games. The studio previously discussed a program dedicated to generating NPC barks, but now has revealed NeoNPC, a generative AI project dedicated to creating full-blown NPC dialogue in video games. Ubisoft released a blog post this morning to pull back the curtain on its new generative AI project called NeoNPC. This project aims to create authentic conversations between the player and NPCs. It's currently being developed by Ubisoft Paris using NVIDIA technology. Have you ever dreamed of having a real conversation with an NPC in a video game? Not just one gated with a dialogue tree of predetermined answers, but an actual conversation conducted through the spontaneous action and reaction? Lately, a small R&D team at Ubisoft's Paris studio, in collaboration with NVIDIA's Audio2Face application and InWorld's large language model, LLM, have been experimenting with generative AI, blah, 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 blah. So they announced Ghost Rider last year at GDC, a program that uses generative AI to create NPC barks during combat sequences. And I'm going to say this is 100% bullshit. Because real dialogue AI, you're not going to have it without some sort of internet connection. It's just too big. You need cloud. You need the cloud to do it. So unless they have games with access to the cloud, it's all bullshit.
Yeah. And even then, like, what a bad time. Because there have been a lot of issues with AI lately. A lot of issues of LLM where they... If it's not being like, if the AI isn't learning to be super racist and rewrite history and do terribly problematic things, then it's stealing from other creatives.
Say what you want about OpenAI, they know how to do their ChatGPT because the ChatGPT will never do anything like that. It's a little bit too self-aware. And I use ChatGPT a lot, not to as a creator, but sort of like a quick questions and answers, you know? Just to get some information like, what do they mean by not before the sun is above the yardarm and stuff like that? You know, things like that. But, yeah, I mean, also, here's the other thing. It sounds good, but in a game like Mass Effect, I would not want the characters to have generated AI. AI dialogue. No. They have specific things to say, and it's part of a story, and, you know, the way they say things is crafted. You know, if it's an open world thing like Grand Theft Auto or something, yeah, I can see it. But you need a scripted dialogue for a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I just think it's strange that they would do this. It's almost as if, with how many weird decisions Ubisoft has made, it's almost like they look at the room, see what's trend. It's almost like they have a set of executives that are just like, what do people hate the most right now, and how do we fit it into our games?
By the way, they didn't Square Enix try it with an adventure game a couple of months ago, and it was a disaster?
I can't.
There was a free adventure game that was on Steam. I think it was by Square Enix. It was a remake of one of their older games, and they included generative AI, and it was a disaster.
Yeah, and that doesn't make people want more AI and like more generative AI in games when they do stuff like that. So I don't understand why Ubisoft would choose to go this route.
Yeah,
I think it was at this time. Their timing is impeccably bad on every level.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the name of the game. Square Enix game. I'm pretty sure it was Square Enix. Oh, right. It was last year, actually, in April. It was called... Oh, the Portopia serial murder case. And it got dreadful reviews. It got dreadful reviews because the quote unquote natural language processing was bad.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a silly move by Ubisoft, though. It's the silliest thing because Ubisoft is capable of good games at certain points in their history, but it just feels like the decisions they've been making lately are just shoddy. Shoddy in every way.
Yeah, we'll see how... See, the last Assassin's Creed game I wanted to like, but they just... They did so many wrong decisions in it, it's not even funny. They screwed up the combat, and because the best thing about the original Assassin's Creed was one-button combat, right? And in this one, it's sort of like, it sucks. It just sucks. I wanted to like it so much, but I couldn't. Moving on to the next item. Pal World propels Xbox to best month ever in console playtime. This comes from Eurogamer. Pocket Pairs Pal World, the game that the internet dubbed Pokemon with Guns ahead of its early access release in January, has been a huge success for both the developer and Xbox. Xbox has celebrated a fast start to 2024, revealing that January was actually its biggest month ever on console in terms of playtime. In a blog post detailing Xbox's efforts to support independent developers, Microsoft highlighted Pal World as a key reason for this record, stated that Pal World has had more than 10 million people on console so far.
That's a lot of people,
including me. I was one of them. Back in January, Microsoft announced Pal World had the biggest third-party launch in Game Pass's history. Meanwhile, Steam, as we all know, Pal World saw 2 million concurrent players recorded, making it only the second game ever to manage this, the other being PUBG. For a while now, the game has only been available on Xbox and PC. There's been talk about it coming to additional platforms down the line. Earlier this year, PlayStation head of indies Shohei Yoshida suggested it was looking to get Pal World on PlayStation. You think? It's a third-party game. I don't think they're going to have any problem getting it on PlayStation. You know?
Yeah.
They may not do it in early access, but it's definitely going to be on PlayStation. It's definitely going to be on... now that I think of it, it might not be on Switch. but despite the success and demand, Pocket Pair plans to remain a small studio, with founder Takuro Mizobi saying he wants to make multiple small games and that big-budget AAA games are not for us. The exec did state he would be open to considering partnership or acquisition offers, however. Oh, really? Is he telling Microsoft, buy us? Please buy us? Is that what he's saying? Because Steam's not going to buy them, but Microsoft definitely will. And here's the thing. I will agree that Pal World is not a big-budget AAA game. It doesn't feel like one. It feels like a AA game. It feels like a fan-made game, you know? It's really good, but it feels like a fan-made game.
And you can say that, like, it can easily be said that the hype has died off a little bit, but even now, the 24-hour peak for this game on SteamDB, and this is just Steam players, mind you, not even including Xbox players, is currently at 98,000. And that's still a lot for an indie game that just kind of came out of nowhere.
It's not been released yet, either. It's not even full.
Yeah. And so, like, when you look at this game, it's up there with Elden Ring and Dead by Daylight, and it's doing better than even Destiny 2 right now. And you can say, well, Destiny 2 is in a slump, but at the same time, how many indie games do you know that outperform Destiny 2 in player counts?
Stardew Valley.
Well, there you go.
But here's the thing. When it's released, it's going to have full co-op, so it's going to have the impetus to have players online, so at least there's that too. I think they're telling Microsoft, please buy us. If they say they're open to considering partnership or acquisition offers, yeah. They saw what Microsoft did with Hi-Fi Rush, and they say, we want that too.
Yeah. And, I mean, you can't say they haven't on some level earned it, at least. But we'll see what happens. They still get a long stretch to get through their early access, because they literally just launched an early access at the beginning of January, or at the midpoint of January.
Yeah.
So it'll probably at least be 2025 before we see a version 1.0 on this.
Yeah, and Microsoft really needs something that's creating waves on the Xbox. I mean, this is creating huge waves.
Yeah, for sure.
Obviously, with 10 million people playing, yeah. And the best part is that, you know, if you're part of Xbox Game Pass or you're doing Xbox Live, you know, you don't have to worry about the servers ever shutting down because they'll be there for the game.
Yeah, and we'll see how it goes. Like, I don't mind seeing Palworld continue to get polished, because they certainly got the money to do it now.
Yeah. I had someone react to a YouTube comment that I made about Hi-Fi Rush and said, you know, when Rekka appears, that's when the game goes from being just fun to absorbing and amazing. And the person reacted, yeah, I just got it on PlayStation 5. I mean, yeah, I agree completely. And that's why I'm happy it's on other consoles, because Hi-Fi Rush needs to be played by everybody. Have you played it yet, TJ?
I have not.
See, that's why you fail.
Aw.
You play all these other rhythm games. You play Crypt of the Necrodancer, and you play, Bullets Per Minute. You should be playing this.
I really should. I do need to make time and just play through it someday.
Here's the thing. It's the best Dreamcast game that never came out on Dreamcast. It is a... If you play it, you're going to say, holy shit, I'm playing a Dreamcast game.
Well, that sounds rad. I mean, it looks like it. I agree with you, too. It does kind of look like that.
It has the same 2000 attitude sort of thing that you saw in games like Jet Set Radio Future and stuff like that. You know, it has that Dreamcast attitude toward it, you know, that really that cocky asshole protagonist. You know, who's a big goofball, but, you know, you can't be mad at him. And the spunky characters. And here's the thing, you know, 808, everybody loves 808, and that's why the game is so popular. I think it's because of 808. For those who don't know, 808 is the robot cat.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the music is fantastic, too.
Yeah, good mix of licensed soundtrack and original music.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. What's interesting is they took the licensed stuff, right? And they actually had a cover by their band. But they also made altered versions of the same songs that were copyright-friendly, that were copyright-free, so they didn't have to worry about it.
Yeah. And so, like, that's becoming an increasingly common thing to have. If you're going to have a licensed soundtrack, you got to have, like, a streamer mode that that includes some level of royalty-free stuff so people don't get in trouble. Because that's just the way things are nowadays.
Yeah, and if you're not going to get an in perpetuity license for a music license for a game, you better have that public domain music ready, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and it's all this, it all the notes. This one game, I guarantee, this is sort of game, an hour in, you'll be grinning as you're playing. It's one of those games, you're just going to be smiling as you play.
Nice.
And one of the things, oh, by the way, the one thing I like about the rhythm-based stuff is that the rhythm-based is, you don't ever fail if you don't do the rhythm. It just means you don't get the extra bonus hits, and you don't get the higher grades. That's all it means.
Yeah, so you don't, it's really more about comboing. The rhythm part of it is really more about comboing than it is about, like, yeah, trying to complete the song or anything like that.
Yeah. So yeah, Hi-Fi Rush is good. We knew that a year ago.
Yep.
And by the way, I said this on this podcast a year ago. I said, this is going to be a Switch game at some point. It screams Switch.
Yeah, I think it'll eventually get there.
No, it is there.
No, you're right.
No, I'm just saying, when it was out, I didn't know it was going to be on PlayStation, but I knew it was going to be on Switch at some point.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Ori and the Blind Forest. He said, this feels like a Switch game that's somehow on the Xbox. And lo and behold, they released it on Switch because they knew it was going to do well on it. So, to end the podcast, I'm going to read each and every one of the patch notes. Add new festivals and events. The Desert Festival is now a 3-day event in spring, which can be accessed after the buses return. Okay. I'm not really going to do that.
Reach the end of that, and I'll look out the window like, oh, the sun's coming up. This was a pretty long episode.
I might do that on a dare, just record it afterwards and just do every single line. God, 19 pages of all this. It's like, a lot of it is just numbers, some numbers, you know, but no, a lot of it is just stuff that he's talking about that added. There's a lot of spoilers in here, too, so I'm trying not to read it too closely.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what were you going to say, TJ?
No, that's about it.
Oh, okay. Anyways, look for our show notes at gamingpodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy your feedback, so leave us comments on our blog at gamingpodcast.net. All set us up at facebook.com/gamingpodcast. You can find me on Twitter/X at Jonah Falcon.
You can find me at Johnny Chugs.
You can find me at Charlie Moore.
And we will see you next week.
Happy gaming, everyone.
Have fun, be cool, play games, y'all.